G'day guys, welcome to this interview episode today. I hope you guys are well. I hope you're having a killer week. Today I have a very awesome interview for you guys where I'll be talking with Richard Delamore, also known as Evil Deer. Maybe you guys have heard of him if you speak Esperanto, but I'll be chatting to him on the podcast today all about how he learnt Esperanto, a constructed language, a language that has no country, and its history is very, very, very recent, how he learnt this online. So, Richard did this all in Australia, obviously. The language doesn't have a country. There's no real place you can go abroad to go and study this language in a fully immersed situation. So, it was a very interesting interview. Now, again, there is a bit of a swear warning on this interview, guys. We do talk a little bit about rude words in Esperanto towards the end of the interview. I just want you to know that that is coming up. It's nothing too severe, but we will be using the odd swear word whilst discussing those kinds of things because I couldn't help myself. I had to ask, how do you swear in a constructed language, right? A language that is only about 100 years old. Anyway, with all that aside, guys, let's dive into it. I give you guys Richard Delamore, also known as Evil Deer. G'day, guys. Welcome to this episode of the Aussie English Podcast. I have Richard here today, who is a fellow Australian and who I knew until recently as Evil Deer. I didn't actually know your first name until recently. But Richard speaks... probably you're the only person I know who speaks a constructed language fluently. So, can you start, Richard, by telling me a bit about you, where you grew up, where you're from, and then how you ended up learning Esperanto?
Yeah, sure. So, my name is Richard, obviously. I grew up in Queensland, in rural Queensland, so in a tiny little town called Emerald, which is basically out middle of nowhere. So, I grew up in that town, and that town is all English speakers, but I think if you go back one generation, it's like German speakers.
No kidding.
So, yeah, it was like tons of immigrants came in. And then I remember when I was growing up, I heard English all around me, so I didn't even know what other languages were. But my grandma would speak German. And I didn't understand German, so I just thought she was speaking a really bad English. Like, that's all I knew, okay? And I remember when we finally, I was about 12 years old, my family decided to move to the coast. And we moved across a few different towns, and that's when I first started noticing that, you know, other languages exist. And I studied Japanese in primary school, and I was mainly there just for the girls. It wasn't actually for the language.
It was like, at least you're honest.
Yeah, you know, got to get these things out of the way. So I was in the class, and I remember I was in that class for like 3 years, and they were just, you know, they were showing all the different signs and what they mean. And I remember one day I'm like, actually, I'm going to write something in Japanese. So I went to my teacher, how do you say the word "da" in Japanese? Mm. And she's like, there is no word for "da." And I was like, what a stupid language. Why doesn't it have "da"? You know, the concept just didn't get to me that, you know, languages are structured differently.
Well, that reminded me when I started French and I was like, what do you mean there's different grammar? I thought it was just you change every word in English into a French word and that's their language, right?
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I thought for like 3 years. It's literally, oh, you just swap words in. You know, it's like the old puzzle book where you swap the head and the body.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it didn't really work out too well. So, I wasted about 4 years on Japanese and I learned how to count. I can still do that. And then after that, I was like, well, obviously, I'm not suited for languages. Yeah. So, I'm going to give up on this. And then after I finished high school, I joined the Australian Army. So I was in the army for 6 years, and they posted me at this place called Singleton, another little town in the middle of nowhere. And there was like literally two or three things I could do. I could go out drinking, I could go out to the cinemas, or I could sit at home playing video games.
Is this in your spare time when you weren't training and shooting at targets and stuff?
Pretty much. So there was like nothing to do out there. It was like the town consists of miners and military, and that's basically it.
Wow. So that sounds like Townsville to me in Queensland.
Oh, it's basically Townsville but smaller.
Yeah. Okay.
So I was sitting there, and after about a year of gaming, I was starting to lose my mind, and I still had a few more years here. So I was looking for things to do, and I don't know, one day I started thinking, maybe I'll go back to, you know, I'll study something from my past that I failed miserably at. But I didn't want to do Japanese at that stage because I had traumatic memories. So I was asking around, and everyone there is like, you know, the older generation, they're all like, oh, you should learn French, you know, the French Empire, you type of thing. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll try French out. So I tried French for about a month, and to me, it was just this weird language where you write like 30 characters and you say like two of them.
Yeah.
And then, like, everything's just smashed together, and they have, like, you know, English with the word don't is, like, do not, and they do that in French, like, on a massive scale. And it just did not make sense to me. There was just all these irregular rules and strangeness, and after a month, I was like, yeah, this ain't happening. So I gave up again. And I remember, I don't know if any of you guys have done this. If you're like me, I'm one of those people who sits on Wikipedia and I'll read an article. I'll click and I'll read and I'll click and I'll read. And I, you know, you start somewhere and you end up somewhere totally different.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they always have like those words highlighted, right? So you'll be reading an article about biology and a term will be highlighted about something completely different.
And you'll be like, I'll read that and I'll come back, but you never do. So I was on one of those Wikipedia dives where I was going through things and somehow I landed on international languages.
No kidding. Okay.
Yeah. And on the page about international languages, it was saying, oh, so international languages are generally, you know, powerful economic languages, English, French, but there's also created languages. And I was like, eh, created?
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds fascinating.
Dothraki, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this would have been before then. Dothraki. Yep.
So the list basically consists of very small and Klingon.
Yeah.
So I clicked on that and I was reading through it and I'm like, oh, okay, this sounds kind of fascinating and really nerdy, you know, something like I'd probably be interested in. And I remember I saw Esperanto in the list, but I skipped over it because I thought it was Spanish. Like, I thought it was Espanol.
I thought it was Castano. Is it Castano? Like the Castellano or whatever. Like when you see that word coming up on subtitles, and that's Spanish, right? And I thought, for some reason I had it in my head when I kept seeing Esperanto a few years ago. I'm like, oh, it's just a different dialect of Spanish or something.
That's exactly what I thought. So I skipped past it, but somehow on my link diving I ended up back on it.
Yeah.
And I remember I was reading it and I was like, this is really fascinating, like some dude created language and now, like, you know, 100 years later people are actually speaking this is like me as a kid making a language, and 100 years from now people like speak it. Like, that's insane. So I was reading it and it was really fascinating, and I got to the part where it says, you know, there's native speakers. And I was like, if it's got native speakers, it must be like a real language.
Exactly.
You can't speak a broken language. So I was like, you know what? I failed at Japanese. French is not doing it for me. I'll give this a shot. You know, I'll give it half an hour. Maybe it's interesting. So I gave it half an hour and I actually understood the concept. So after half an hour, I was like, wow, I speak more of this than Japanese and, you know, French that I'd been learning before. And I was just like, well, between gaming sessions, I'll come back and I'll do more lessons.
Yeah.
So it was one of those things where I'd do like, you know, half an hour a day for fun and then I'd go back to gaming and I can claim I'm being productive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's like that carrot and the stick, right? When you're rewarding yourself. And
Yeah, pretty much.
So can you tell us about how it was designed, how it was made, and why?
So basically the guy who created it, his name was Zamenhof. He comes from what's now Poland, so Bialystok, which is like one of the main cities there. And he came from this city, which at the time was like this little town on the edge of the Russian Empire, okay?
Yep.
Because Poland was controlled by Russia.
Yep.
Anyway, in that town, it was very divided between language groups. So you had German speakers, Yiddish speakers, Polish speakers, Russian speakers, and they didn't like each other. They didn't speak to each other. You know, they had to put up with each other. It sounds like any other town, I guess. So they're all like squished in there together, and he kept thinking from when he was young, why don't we just have like one universal language? And his idea originally was to try and revive Latin.
Yeah.
So he went and learnt Latin.
Well,
and
so you like, start with what's there, right? You're like, okay, this language is made. I just have to learn it.
Yeah, pretty much. He's like, I'll learn Latin and I'll promote it. So he went and learned Latin. He's like, yeah, that was a bad idea.
How long did it take him too? Because that's the part that's always put me off. That was a subject at my school when I was there. And I remember the guys just being like, this is like grammar lessons from hell constantly, and no one knows how to speak it properly. It's just, you know, it's the Matrix.
The grammar of Latin is insane. Like, I've been learning it actually for a few months now, and just because of interest sake. And
just
because
you hate yourself.
Yeah, pretty much. I like self, you know, flatulation, I guess, whatever. But anyway, so it's pretty insane. And then after that, he's like, well, I'm going to standardize Yiddish and make that the language of the Jewish diaspora, okay?
Yep.
So he went around doing that, and he even put a dictionary and everything together, and he's like, but no one really cares about that. So he kind of gave up on that. Then he's like, okay, so why don't I create a language that's a mixture of all the European languages? So he created it, and he put it together, and he actually did all this before he got to uni. So he was really young.
Far out. I was wondering, I was going to say, what was he doing for work? While he was creating these languages, but obviously he didn't have to have a job because he was at home, you know, living with his folks.
Well, I guess that was before Xboxes existed, so people... So anyway, he created it, and then his dad's like, you're wasting your time. So he burnt all his notes when he went off to uni. So then he recreated it.
Because he already spoke it, obviously, so it was all committed to memory, yeah. Huh?
I think he knew most of it, but it was probably a good thing, because then he refined it.
Man, how pissed would you be? You'd be like, Dad.
Oh, yeah. God damn it, Dad. Anyway, so he then put it all together, and his original idea was not to create, say, a language where we just go around speaking it. It was to create, like, this booklet form where you have a language in a booklet, and you use it as, like, a translation guide quickly to write letters.
Okay.
So you'd have a letter, you'd look at the book, and you'd just check across and go, okay, this is how I write it, and I send the letter, and then the person will translate it back into their own language.
Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah, so it was meant to be like that, but he also, in the back of his mind, had the idea that, you know, I could make this into a language. So he tried translating all sorts of different stuff. And the original idea was, I'll publish this booklet, and at the end of the booklet, there's this thing that says, sign up to this, send it to me, and if a million people sign up, I'll let you all know, and we'll all learn it together.
Yep.
Okay. So a bunch of people decided, well, I'm not going to wait for a million people, and they just went and started learning it. And then they started contacting him, and then from there, it just started growing. So we had a few speakers, and then we had a couple of hundred, and then in 20 years, they had the first big international meeting. And it just
and the crazy thing is, this was all happening in the late 1800s, early 1900s, right? Around that time?
Yeah, this is like right before World War One.
Yeah, yep.
Yeah, so right at a time frame where everyone's trying to kill everyone.
There's no internet, there's no digital era. It's all, you know, writing on paper, right? And sending each other letters and getting pamphlets and stuff from one another.
Yeah, and you got to remember that, like, the rate at which these things get sent between each other. But somehow this all managed to grow, and a community of speakers from all around the world managed to actually start appearing and using this language. We even had people in Australia back in the early, like, 1900s who, like, signed up to his letters and were learning it. So, like...
Wow. So he was sending these letters out to everyone, was he?
Yeah. Yeah, he was sending them out of, like, around Europe, to the Americas, down to Australia. This is when it was all just mail. It's crazy.
So how did it maintain itself, though? Because I would imagine back then the language would have been somewhat infantile in, like, the size of the vocabulary and everything. So you might have got the grammar sorted out, right? And that's one of the beautiful things about Esperanto, is that there's no exceptions. The grammar is perfect and there are no broken rules like in English or like in any language. But what happened when people wanted to have words, you know, say for didgeridoo or for kangaroo in Australia? Were they able to just create their own words, use the English ones, or did they have to, like, ask for him to make up words for them to be able to talk about? How did that get maintained?
Yeah, so he was very different. I'd say he's kind of like the first person to open source something, because what he did is at the beginning of the book, he literally straight away said, this doesn't belong to me, it belongs to you, the speakers. And if a word doesn't exist or a concept doesn't exist, take the most international concept and import it into Esperanto.
Okay.
So to give you an idea, as Esperanto spread around, words like for local regional things just didn't exist. So people would be like, oh, well, I just write my, like, an Esperanto version of what I say.
Exactly.
And then that started spreading around. Like, the word for chopstick in Esperanto is hashio, which comes from Japanese, because the Japanese needed a word for it.
Yep.
So that's how it got into the language, and it spread around. So it's just...
So it was all passive, just naturally occurred. There was no active, make sure that we have to collect all the Japanese vocab they've made in Japan and the Australian words and put them all together. Yep. It just happened passively, did it?
Yeah, and at some times you'd have competing word forms, and then eventually one would beat out the others and it would spread through the whole community. Like back in the early 80s, I think it was, when computers first started appearing, there was no word for computer.
Yep.
Now, there was several different competing forms. There was computilo, which literally means tool for computing, tool for calculating.
Yep.
And then other people were inventing words like computero, which was just a ripoff from English. And there was a bunch of others, and they were all fighting for a period of a few years, and then computilo simply slowly took over the whole community, became the standard word, and the other ones fell out of use.
But that's crazy. I can't imagine that happening early on such a massive scale, right? Like, because you can imagine, oh, yeah, you just make a language, you know, you just have to make the basic grammar and then expand out from there. But it's like, you know how many words there are in a language. That would be such a huge task. But open sourcing it was obviously the easiest way for it to be done, and the best sounding words in these cases obviously just get picked up.
Yeah.
So has Esperanto, it started, I thought, as was it Polish, Yiddish, English, some Spanish and French as well, in all mixed into the one language? Is it now, like, it literally has almost at least a word from every language in the world kind of thing, or at least all the common ones, because it's got speakers everywhere?
So I don't think it's got a word from every language in the world, but what it has done is it has taken words over time from different language sources. So at the beginning of Esperanto's history, this was a time when French was the international language. So people back then, if you were educated, you spoke French. So yeah. A lot of the early words that came into Esperanto were actually taken from French.
So that's why it has a French flavor to it.
Yeah. And then as English started to take over, a lot of the words started coming in from English.
Gotcha.
So a lot of the scientific terms, modern scientific terms, are actually very English-based, but a lot of, like, you know, descriptive, poetic words, all these types of other types of words are all French. And then, of course, you get a small smattering of words that come in from other languages. So you got, like, words about anything to do with Islam has basically been imported from Arabic.
Yeah.
Certain, like, East Asian things like chopsticks and stuff have been ported in from those
languages. Like culturally specific things that they're going to need to be able to refer to and talk about all the time get named by those people.
Yep.
Oh, crazy. So what was the process like for learning this language? If it is obviously not as common, you would imagine, as French or Italian with regards to being taught anywhere and having resources, what did you do when you were in Singleton in the army, you know, trying to learn this language for which, and which year was this? Was this, you know, 10 or so years back, or?
This was in 2010.
2010.
Yeah, so it was actually fascinating because I remember for the first 3 months I was learning it for fun and I had no idea that anyone actually, like, spoke it nearby.
Yep.
So I was just learning it more for, you know, my own sake. And then after 3 months, I was like, I wonder if anyone does speak it nearby. So I started searching, and I found there was a group about an hour and a half away from Singleton. And I decided to jump in my car one weekend and drive down there. And I got a train and, you know, trained all the way down there. And I remember when I arrived, I had, like, the phone number of the person I was meeting up with, but I didn't really have any other details. And I was sitting there, and I'm like, I called the number. I'm like, yeah, hello, it's me. I'm the new guy who contacted you. And the dude was standing right next to me. I didn't even realize. And he's this, like, massive Russian dude that looks like he's from the mafia type of thing. Like, big guy, okay, beefy. But he's, like, the kindest guy in the world. And then he introduced me to the local group there, which consisted of speakers out of Korea, out of Russia, out of, like, here in Australia. And it was a very small, knit community because this is outside of Sydney. And then after I left the army, I moved to Sydney. And in Sydney, there's a really vibrant community. There's a lot of speakers here. So I'd say probably all up maybe 100.
Yep.
You don't meet all of them. In fact, I probably haven't met all of them. But there's different, like, hangouts where you go. So, like, if you're in this type of group, you go to this one. It's kind of like friend groups type of thing.
No kidding.
And they all kind of cross over each other. So if you're in a major city, it's pretty much guaranteed that the speakers around you. It's just a matter of finding them. And once you find them, they'll connect you with the others.
What are their motivations for learning the language? Do you find that it's always the exact same thing for you? Boredom begins it? Or is it completely different, you know, left of field reasons for beginning Esperanto as a foreign language?
It's actually really different for different people. Like, one of the people here, Nicole, she speaks Esperanto because she learned it as a child.
Oh, wow. So she's a native speaker, is she?
She's basically, yeah. So I think she learned it a little bit later in her childhood, but she still learned it as a child. And it's been in her family for a few generations. So for her, it's a cultural thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So for me, I learned it out of boredom. But, you know, the Russian guy I said, Dimitri, before he moved to Australia, he didn't speak English. He learned Esperanto, came here, connected with the Esperanto community, got, like, work and everything. And then from there, started learning English.
Yeah, because I've heard, too, people use or can use, or it's even suggested to use, especially for polyglots, Esperanto as a kind of stepping stone into the world of learning languages. Is that something you find a lot of people have done, too, where they've said, okay, I'm interested in becoming a polyglot, learning, you know, 2, 3, 10, 100 languages. Do you find that they quite often start with Esperanto because of the grammar and the speed at which you can pick it up and learn to use it relatively easily?
I found it kind of from two directions. There's kind of two fonts. So one is people like me who come to Esperanto first and then go, oh, wow, this is amazing, learn a language, and then they learn more and become polyglots.
Yeah.
Or there's the polyglots who already have 10 languages under their belt and they want to look awesome, so they put Esperanto down.
Well, they're at 9, are they? And they're just like, I need to get those double digits.
I need that 10th. I'm going to get an easy one so I can fill it out. So I kind of see Esperanto as like a, it's like the soft drug before you get to the hardcore languages.
Mm-hmm.
So you're like, oh, I'll dabble in this one. You learn it, you get addicted, and then next thing you know, you're learning Chinese and these other languages because or once you've done it once.
It's where you're doing all the drugs already and you're like, well, I might as well pick this one up as well.
Yeah. I'm in the pool. I can't get out now.
Far out. So how did you go about learning it though? What was the process back in 2010? Obviously you had the internet and everything. Are there a lot of resources for learning Esperanto compared to other languages you've tried learning, or is it very sparse and you know, few and far between?
Even back in 2010, which was kind of early during the Esperanto era on the internet, one of the biggest language learning websites in the world was devoted to Esperanto. It's learnu.net.
It still exists. Yeah.
Yeah, and I pretty much learned the entire language on that website.
No kidding.
Yeah, from beginner to like fluency. Like I practiced there, I met people in there, I chatted with them, and I went on the forums, and then you know got into grammar discussions, the whole works, all within that one website before I started meeting people. But nowadays, in the last 8 years, the amount of resources I would say is like quadruple. It's like massively expanded.
Yeah.
So you can pretty much learn Esperanto from any language in the world, like in that language.
Someone's created the content in Japanese, in Korean, in English, in every language now.
Yeah. So like in here in Sydney, there's a house. It's kind of like a cultural center for Esperanto. It's called the Esperanto House. If you go in there, you can find like books in pretty much any language to learn Esperanto and translations of pretty much anything in Esperanto. So like on one shelf, they've got like the Holy Quran in Esperanto and then the Bible on top of it in Esperanto. So it's like you can get a translation of anything in it.
But can you get Harry Potter and Game of Thrones? That's the most important stuff, man. Yeah.
Interesting one about Harry Potter. You can get it, but it's not sanctioned.
What do you mean it's not done officially by them?
Yeah.
So you got to download the illegal PDF.
Yeah, I'm not promoting that. I'm just saying, you know, it does exist out there. I don't know the full story behind it, but I heard like the first book was fully translated. And then I think it was given to the publisher. Something happened. They rejected it. So somehow it leaked onto the internet.
Ah, whoops.
Yep.
So what was that process like though? Because, and this is what I think is going to be really important for my listeners. A lot of them are obviously using digital resources. They're learning at home. They're learning at their own, in their own countries without any native speakers around. Did you obviously had to go through that process to begin with where it was literally just you and a computer, was it?
Yep.
What was the process like? You just spent half an hour a day or an hour a day? Did you get sucked in and started doing, you know, 8 hours a day instead of gaming, or was it just a steady and slow process?
It was kind of like, at first, it was a steady process, so I'd do like half an hour a day. And because every time I did half an hour, I actually made progress. You know, like if you study Latin, after half an hour, you haven't made progress.
Yeah.
You just hurt your brain. So after half an hour in Esperanto, you can now structure a new sentence. You can now ask a question. Another half an hour, you can make this complex sentence. So you feel like there's success each time you do a lesson.
So you get that a lot sooner, those hits and the rush.
You get that kind of hit. So for me, it was just like, oh, well, this is still easy. I'll just keep doing it, you know? And I just kept kind of doing it over and over. And then when I moved to Sydney, somehow, like, I got sucked into the community here. And next thing you know, people are signing you up to do different stuff. And, you know, you're speaking here, or you're, like, you're meeting people there, you're teaching here. And the next thing you know, it's kind of your life.
So what was that moment like when you realized that you were fluent in the language? And how quickly did that come after you began?
Well, I never really noticed when I became fluent. Like, it's hard to say. Like, I noticed on my first meeting, that was actually really impressive for me, because after my first meeting, which was 3 months in, I met with Dmitry, the Russian guy, and a bunch of others. And although I couldn't say everything I wanted to say, I understood everything.
Yep.
And that was 3 months in. And I was like, what? That's insane. But the moment I realized that I was like 100% fluent was when I was having a conversation in Esperanto with a Chinese Esperanto speaker, and we're talking about cryptocurrencies and how it all works and stuff like that. And I was like, I didn't even realize like at first that this guy is like, we don't share a language type of thing,
yeah,
apart from Esperanto.
Yeah.
And we're having these really in-depth conversations about cryptocurrencies, politics, you know, what's happening around the world. So that's kind of the moment where you just realize, and you're just like, oh, okay, I guess I'm fluent now.
That's giving me goosebumps, because I remember that feeling from French. I learned French all through school, sucked at it, I did it for 6 years at school, and then for 10 years I didn't touch it. And then I picked it up at home and started learning it after meeting a few French people at the gym where I was training and talking to them quite a lot. And then eventually I got to that point where I could have conversations with people who were from foreign countries who spoke French but didn't speak English. And yeah. I remember having that penny drop where you're like, holy crap, I'm communicating with someone who doesn't speak English, you know, my native yeah. language. And that gave me that kind of like, I don't know, that feeling that this is all worth it. Languages are so important. And, you know, that it put me on that thirst to want to learn other languages. And now I speak Portuguese with my wife every day. And
yeah.
it's just so motivating. So did you sort of use Esperanto as a springboard onto other languages as well? Or did you get really sucked into that community and you're like, man, I ain't got time for anything else?
Well, I got sucked into that community for a while. And like, I didn't have time for anything else. But then I met my wife, who's Chinese.
Oh, wow.
So then I was like, well, I want to speak your language because her parents don't speak English.
Yep. Yeah, so exactly. I'm in the same boat. Although I think Portuguese is probably going to be an easier mountain for me to climb than Chinese, so respect.
It's been it's given me a lot more respect for Esperanto because, you know, in Chinese is like Latin. You do a bunch and you feel like you've made no progress.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it's got like you need to learn 8,000 signs, like individual characters, to be able to read a book.
Say to them, I'm just Skype calls. There's no writing letters to one another. Screw that. We're just talking, okay?
Well, the annoying thing is my in-laws, they speak Mandarin, but they mainly speak their own local dialect, so it's actually easier to get the characters. Yeah. So, yeah, it's one of the interesting things about the springboard effect is, though, when I'm looking at Chinese, I'm like, oh, that's kind of like Esperanto. So I just kind of superimpose my Esperanto thinking onto Chinese, mm-hmm. and then it gives me that, like, jump forward type of thing. But if I came at Chinese, like, with no other language behind me, I can imagine it'd be so hard to succeed. It's like you probably did this in school, and for international people, they probably don't get this, but we all did the recorder in school
mm-hmm.
before we jumped onto the other instruments.
Yeah.
So Esperanto is like the recorder. I chewed mine, but it's still like the recorder.
It still works.
Yeah, it works. And then you move on to the other instruments. You don't just, I know a lot of people do, but you generally don't go, here's a trumpet, make it happen.
Yeah.
Unless you really want to traumatize people, but it's like that. So if you go for Esperanto, yeah, you're going to be like spending a lot of time learning this language, but it will give you kind of that jump up for the next one.
So how did learning Esperanto beforehand, and obviously to a very high level, set you up to approach Chinese? Did you have a certain, okay, I have to learn this incredibly difficult language, but I have a plan now that I've done it before? Or did you just say, winging it?
Well, it's actually a little bit of both. So when I came at it, I learned from the mistakes I made in Esperanto regarding language learning.
Yep.
So I learned straight away that the best way to learn is to use.
Yeah.
So the more you use, the better you go. And anyone who thinks that they can sit there and just quietly like mime things while they're typing on their computer, it's not a way to learn a language.
Well, it's one of those things, right, where it needs to be, if you're going to do anything like that, it has to be as a sort of supplement, right? You take calcium pills, but you can't live off them, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's good supplement, but you got to go straight at it. So I learned that valuable lesson. And the second thing is that a lot of it's due to Esperanto's history. It has a really big speaker base in China itself.
Got your door in.
Yeah. So, one, I've got a lot of connections there, but also Chinese had an impact on Esperanto grammar as it evolved early in the history.
No kidding.
So things like verbs and adjectives in Esperanto can kind of mix together, meld together, which you can't do in English. But in Chinese, verbs and adjectives are basically the same thing. So it kind of gave me that whole, oh, wow, so you can do that here type of thing, which if I didn't learn that from Esperanto, I'd have to learn that whole new concept. And there's also the fact that a lot of verbs in Esperanto are similar to their Chinese verb form, like in their semantic meaning,
yep.
not in their like pronunciation. But in English, it's different. So yep. in Esperanto, I'm trying to think of a good example right now, but I can't.
Well, you don't have to conjugate them, right? So, like, I remember I did Chinese in high school for a few years as well before I just packed it in and gave up.
Yep.
But I remember you didn't have to conjugate, and that was like, I was like, what? There's no future tense, past tense, present tenses. There's no different pronoun conjugations. The first thing was like, yes. But the second thing was like, how the hell do I describe, you know, yesterday I had been thinking about this thing before lunch. I remember that sort of the two-edged blade when that happened. So how do you get around that in languages like Esperanto or Chinese?
So, for instance, even with Esperanto, there's a lot of things you'd say in Esperanto that you just wouldn't say in English. Like, I'll give you an example would be, Teal Manka Sanmi, which means that is lacking to me.
Yep.
You wouldn't say that in English. You'd say, I don't have that.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you got to do is you don't practice individual, like, say, a verb. You practice it in a structure.
Yeah, exactly.
So you practice the whole thing as one, and then you swap out the noun, and you put a different noun in, and then you swap out that noun, and you practice that structure, and that's how you kind of meld it into your brain.
So what do you do with learning Chinese currently? Because that was the same thing. I had an approach to French where I was totally on my own, and I used – well, totally on my own. I used a few people that I would practice with online, but it was pretty much me, and you can see I've been practicing my grammar in Portuguese.
Yeah,
doing this sort of writing out, you know, lines on a book, practicing the conjugations, speaking at home. But with Portuguese, I just try and talk as much as possible. And I haven't really opened a grammar book. I just ask questions. I forget it 10 times and I just have to keep harassing my wife. Like, how do I say this again in this tense? Blah, blah, blah. But I found that even though I think in French, I had a much wider range of things I could talk about, I made a lot more mistakes and I couldn't talk about them in as a sophisticated manner as I think I can now with simpler things. Because every day we talk about the same things. What do you want for lunch? What are you doing tonight? Did you want to see my sister? Do you want to do this? And it's almost a bad thing because now when I meet Brazilians, I sound like I'm a lot better than I am about those things. But as soon as they go away from the sort of central core of the language that I have, I'm like, oh, crap, I'm in the deep water and I can't swim. Yep. How are you doing that with Chinese? Is that the same sort of process?
It's exactly the same process. And I have the exact same thing. So because my wife's here, she corrected my accent at the beginning.
Yeah,
constantly.
Brilliant. Yeah, yeah.
So I sound way better than I actually am. So I'll be like in a conversation. I can speak about, you know, stuff around the home. I want to eat this. I want to do this, blah, blah, blah. No problem, okay?
Yeah.
And then I'll speak with like one of her friends and they're like, wow, he's so fluent. What do you think about this political situation? I'm like, what?
Zero, yeah.
And I'm like, yeah. Good, yeah, man.
I know, that's the biggest... You get blindsided, right? We had friends over yesterday, and that happened to me, where we were sitting down, and it was good. 90% of the time, I can kind of engage, I make mistakes, but then all of a sudden, you'll have this thing where you're like, this is my vocabulary, you know, bucket, and it's empty.
Yeah, I get that all the time. Like, my wife says I have this amazing ability to stretch absolutely every single word I know into a sentence.
You can bring it all back on itself.
Yeah.
So, what's it like... Talking about accents, does Esperanto have an accent? And how did you learn it, if it does?
It does have an accent in a way. So you know when someone's speaking Esperanto accent is when you can't pick up where they're from.
Yeah.
So there's kind of this neutralized accent, and people have tried to pinpoint what it sounds like, but it's its own thing. Mm-hmm. Okay, so maybe it's kind of like this Latin type of sounding thing, but it may be similar to Italian, but also not similar to Italian. Maybe it's similar to like the Latin that comes out of Polish or like Belarusian. It's hard to say. But you know when someone's speaking Esperanto well is when you can't pick up where they're from and you understand everything.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. So the only thing I can kind of say is about with the accent is there's in the Esperanto community there's kind of two ways to pronounce the R. So some people will tap and some will roll. And you can kind of guess from what countries they're from depending on which one they use.
South America, you guys are doing that.
Yeah.
The T-flat sounds, gotcha.
Yeah, while the rest of the world taps. But even in Esperanto, it's kind of standardized. And even those people who traditionally roll now go to a tap because otherwise they sound weird. So it does kind of have its own neutral accent, I guess.
Far out. Well, I mean, finishing up, what was the hardest part about getting to, you know, a very fluent level with a constructed language for which there are very few speakers, at least locally, for the majority of us, you would imagine, until you dive in if you're living in a big city? What was the most difficult aspect?
Well, one of the most difficult aspects for me was just that lack of filmed material. I'm a, like, visual learner.
Me too.
So when I learned Esperanto, there was videos on YouTube, but not that much. And I pretty much consume them all to kind of get the sound of the language and the rhythm and everything down. And that's actually why I started my own YouTube channel.
Yeah, we should get onto that as well. Yeah, tell us about your YouTube channel because it's just crazy. When I remember seeing it, and I'm like, because I thought there must be Esperanto channels out there, but it would always be polyglots who are just talking in Esperanto or about it for a few minutes and that was it. So how did you begin that too?
So I started my YouTube channel about 3 years ago or something, maybe a bit more. Anyway, when I started, I was like, I got two aims for this. One, to give new learners something to listen to, and two, just to practice it myself.
Yeah.
Because if I, and I actually had a goal that I'd make one video every day for a year, and I hit that goal.
Wow.
Which is crazy.
That's insane. That's a lot of content for someone who makes videos on YouTube maybe once every 2 weeks. Jesus.
Yeah. And I remember, like, my ability just went through the roof because I was constantly in a situation where, like, I'm making a vlog about my life, and I'd point at something and I'd be like, what's the word for that?
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd have to write it down, go look it up, then redo the blog because I didn't know how to say that one word.
Yeah.
And even now when I'm making vlogs, every now and then I'll still come across something. Like the other day I came across – I was talking about a daddy long legs on
the
wall.
Like, yeah, yeah.
How do I say this in Esperanto? So I had to go look it up.
And what was it?
It's a falangio.
And what would that literally translate as? Literally daddy long legs or?
No, that's the Latin-based name for it.
Ah, that's the easy way out, guys.
Yeah. What happens a lot with Esperanto names for animals is that if it's not a common animal, the Latin word gets absorbed into Esperanto for that. So it's kind of crazy because when I look at a Latin text, I can actually pick up a lot of what's written there, even though I don't speak Latin because I'm like, well, got a lot of it from Esperanto. So just doing videos every single day, and it's a great way to learn a language, any language.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. Would you suggest people who are learning, say, English, people listening to this, would you ever suggest for them to create their own content on YouTube or, you know, a podcast or even just film themselves talking to try and really, you know, motivate them and get them using the language? Because I can imagine that must really help.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things that really helped was when I'd make a video, I'd upload it, people would comment on when I made a mistake, not just because I temporarily made a mistake, but because I was actually making a grammar mistake.
Yeah.
And that helped me improve so much. I still get it now. Like every now and then someone will point out something. I'm like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. And that helps so much. So obviously you're putting yourself out there. That's kind of a scary thing for a lot of people. But if you do that and you commit to, say, a period of time where you're going to practice, say, English, you're going to come across this point where you're like, whoa, I'm learning all these new words because previously – in this situation, I wouldn't speak English.
Yeah,
I'd only speak it in this situation. It's that whole box, what we were talking about earlier, where you have your box of goodies that you use because you're only ever in that situation. But if you force yourself to talk about everyday topics, you're going to end up talking about the most random things and you're going to have to know those words.
Far out. And so does your wife speak Esperanto as well? Are you guys thinking about having kids in the future and teaching them a bunch of these different languages? Or?
She started learning Esperanto this year. Yep. Not this year, like a few days ago.
Is it going to be a race to see who gets to fluency first in each other's respective languages?
Well, I remember when I met her, this is going back about 5 years now, I was like, hey, you should come and learn Esperanto, you know, hang out and meet my friends because all my friends are Esperanto speakers. And she's like, I'll learn Esperanto when you learn Chinese.
Challenge accepted. That's it. So, she got the easy end of the stick as well, right?
Like, yeah, she got the easy one. So now she is learning Esperanto, and she knows enough swear words and knows enough to know what I'm talking about her.
How were the swear words made in Esperanto too? What was the sort of way in which they were created, from which language, and is it the same as every language, you know, where it's just genitals, going to the toilet, all of those sorts of words, or is it very creative?
There is a lot of different ones, and there's some that are, like, so wild. Like, I don't know if I'm allowed to mention them on this type of thing.
Ah, go for it, man, go for it.
Oh, okay, well, I'm gonna have fun then. So, like, let's look at one, which is, like, a favorite of me and my friends, and it's idle cutsen. So, idle means it's a command, go towards.
Yep.
And katsen, katso is the word for penis. It's a slang word for penis.
Yep.
And katsen means toward a penis. So it's literally saying you go toward the head of a penis.
That's great. And has that been around since the very beginning, or are they sort of, is it evolving and developing even more today?
It's evolving because Zamenhof was like a real prude. He wouldn't talk about those types of topics.
Yeah.
So back in the 30s, I remember reading about a poet. I forget his name. People are going to drill me for this. He made something called La Secrete Sonetoi, which is like the secret sonnets.
Yeah.
And he basically grabbed a whole heap of words from Slavic languages and used them in place of like all these rude words. And a lot of those now are kind of what's used for slang words, like for the vocab. But then also others have evolved into the language.
Yep.
And it just kind of randomly appears. Like one of my favorites, my friend, he kind of made it up on the spot based on like an English concept, and it kind of spread for Esperanto, was fecante katsitsui, which means shitting dip Vic Nipples. So it's like nipples are chic. And people use it in my YouTube channel all the time now. They're like commenting and stuff. And it's just... It just spreads.
It's one of those things. I love swearing. I love swearing in other languages. It's one of those things that just, it's a good way to have a laugh. I mean, you know, you've got to pick when you do it and how you do it and with whom you do it, but it's always something fun. And, you know, it can be, it causes a lot of hilarity in your life. But, yeah, that's crazy. Is there slang as well? The final question, is there slang and how does that develop? You know, because Australia's got heaps of slang different from England, America, any country you go to that speaks English. Is it the same with slang in Esperanto?
Yeah, there's a fair bit of slang in Esperanto. A lot of the traditional type of speakers who don't like that type of stuff, they'll try and deny its existence, but it definitely exists. Like, I'll give you an example. The word moyosa means cool.
Yeah.
Now, they actually know the history behind that word. If you go back to 2005, there was an international meetup of young Esperanto speakers, and they wanted to have a word similar to the English cool in Esperanto.
As in, that thing is awesome, not just the temperature's low.
Yeah. They wanted to have something that meant that thing is like awesome in that sense.
Yeah.
So they were saying moderna yuna stila, which means young youth style.
Yeah.
Okay. And then they kind of just crammed it together to become moyosa.
Yeah,
and
so then it just got contracted.
Yeah, it has spread through the Esperanto community. So in a lot of languages, the word for cool is literally ripped from English.
Yeah.
But in Esperanto, it was kind of an acronym that evolved into a slang.
And you guys still use okay, like every language seems to use?
Not really. We say bone.
Ah, cool.
So bone literally means good.
Oh, awesome. Well, Richard, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Where can people find out more about you and obviously learn more about Esperanto?
Well, if you want to like hear some spoken Esperanto, you can always go to my YouTube channel. So it's Evil Deer, EVILDEA. Just go to YouTube, type that in, it'll pop up near the top. If you want to learn some Esperanto, there's like you can go to the website lernu.net, LERNU.net. I always think of Esperanto. Or you could just go to Duolingo like you did and just download the Esperanto.
That was the best part, I think, when I heard about Duolingo coming out, because I knew the guy, I've forgotten his name, who was behind that project. I had a friend who was really good friends with him. I knew how much the resources were going behind it and how he was going to make it really, really good quality. And it was really, really good quality on Duolingo, unlike some of the other languages on there where there's no sound or it's pretty limited. So yeah, definitely Duolingo was awesome. Anyway, thank you so much, mate. I really appreciate it.
No problem, man.
Awesome, guys. Well, I hope you enjoyed today's interview. Don't forget to sign up to the Aussie English Classroom if you would like to complete all of my courses to improve your English. And if you would like the transcripts for this episode as well and the MP3s, go to the podcast, the Aussie English podcast.com, and you can sign up there for the price of a coffee a month or so in order to get access to all the downloads for the podcast. Thanks so much for joining me, guys, and I'll chat to you soon. Peace out.